Welcome to Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life. Each month, Galley Table Storytelling hosts a live event in the Kodiak community. Storytellers are given 7 minutes to tell a personal story related to a monthly theme. Tonight, we'll hear those stories.
This edition of Galley Tables was recorded on January 8, 2016 at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. The theme was Man's Best Friend.
Catherine is a professor of business and accounting at Kodiak College. She has lived in Kodiak for nearly 7 years, and teaching is her second career after a successful 24-year stint as a healthcare administrator. She has a passion for all kinds of dogs, and in her free time likes to knit and work on her dissertation research. Please welcome her to the stage.
A couple things you should know about me before I begin. First of all, three things, actually. I grew up kind of foster homes, and not really foster homes, but two families basically didn't want anything to do with me. So I, as I've grown up, have had a hard time connecting with people at a deep level. Okay, I can talk and I can connect with students and things, but okay, so that's part of it. Second of all, I own a business in town teaching people how to protect themselves from cold water. And so you can imagine where this is going. I teach CPR, first aid, aquatics, all of those things. And I guess those are the important things. So I'm going to tell my story. And the third thing I want you to know is I moved here in 2009 to work for the hospital. And wasn't really interested in fishing, sorry. But I hired who is now I consider my BFF from Oregon. She was a nurse. She came to work for me, and shortly after she came, I left the hospital, and so we became very close friends. Well, Lori wanted nothing to do anything but fish. So in order to spend time with my best friend, I had to fish. And so one day I decided to go with her. I went to Max, and I bought everything I needed to fish. None of it fit me because they didn't have my size. I didn't care. I just wanted to be warm. So September 25th, we're out in 2010. Now I've been here a little over a year. I went out with her and her husband to the Buskin River, and we fished for probably an hour. This is Lolly. This is who I'm talking about. And Lolly has always swam around me, and my students tell me that's why I never catch anything. But I don't care. It's about being there with her. So after about an hour of not even getting a bite, this Swedish guy comes, and he goes, "Lolo!" And he gets the most beautiful silver on the first thing, you know, whatever you call it, swoosh, cast, thank you, I've ever seen. And he goes, "Oh, cool." And he walks away, and I was like, that's so not fair. So now I'm obsessed. I'm going to get one of these millions of silver fish that are jumping in the water. And because I have men's size 10 chest waders on me, and they have boots, and they're all kind of crumpled up, and so they're really warm because they're neoprene, I get in the middle of the river, and Lolly's swimming around me, just dog paddling around. And I cast as far as I can. Nothing. But there's a million silver lights, you know, because September, they're everywhere. I keep walking down the river following these casting for these fish, and I still never get a bite. Well, after about 2.5 hours of this, Lolly's getting cold, I'm getting cold, and I still haven't gotten a bite. I've been out for now 3 or 4 hours. But I left my friends behind, and I decided, since Lolly had gotten up on the bank, that it was time for me to probably go in. Well, I walked over in the river to the bank, and it's like this high and slimy and wet, and I'm wearing things that are way too big, and so I can't get up on the bank. So I go back to the middle of the river, and I'm going to walk. Well, as I'm kind of walking around this big flat rock underneath the water, this fisherman gets in the water over there, and he comes back kind of catty-corner across the river, and he goes, "Wow, your fishing buddy sure sticks with you." And I go, "Yeah, she's always with me. But my students tell me that's why I never catch anything." And he laughed and walked off. Well, I get around to this rock is probably this big and flat and kind of And it's under the water, like I said. There's a hole over there. I don't know it, of course, because I don't know the river very well, and this is probably only my fourth time out fishing. And I fall in the hole. And all of the things that I taught for 15 years in four different states were gone. I was hypothermic. I was going into shock. I was losing consciousness. The more I fought being, you know, underwater, my boots that are now, you know, again, men's size 10, they're this far below my feet now and filled with water. And the more I kick, the more they weigh me down. So I thought for sure I was a goner. At one point, I went under and I came up for a second before as things started filling up, and I saw Lolly jump in the water, and all I remember is thinking, don't come out here, I can't help you. And for some reason, I kept a hold of my fishing pole, like it's going to help me. And I'm kicking and drowning, basically, and I'm starting to lose consciousness, but I feel Lolly go like this. And I thought she was trying to take the fishing pole away. But I grabbed her collar, and she towed me probably only to 8 feet that I was from shore, but it was enough to get my feet on the ground. I still couldn't get up on the bank, but apparently when I fell in, a fisherman a little down the river had gone out and ran around, and he was there when she brought me to the shore, helped me get up. As hypothermic as I wasn't clearly thinking. I couldn't find my friends. I didn't know where my car was. I went, you know, one way, probably, I'm sure, the wrong way. And after about a half an hour of the water in my waders warming up and actually warming me up, I just sat in the middle of the road along the Buskin River and cried because I didn't know what to do. And Lolly just sat there with me. Well, little did I know that a bear had been following me down the river. And so my friends got worried because I had disappeared a couple hours ago, and then there's this bear. So my friend Lori started driving down, and she found me. Again, she's a nurse. She knew I was hypothermic. She knew all the signs. Called my husband, called her husband, said, get her car. I'm taking her home. Long story short, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for Lolly.
For our second storyteller of the night, we have Dan Wheeler. And so he is a lifelong resident of Kodiak, and he is a lover of the sweet island life. He enjoys early morning Tai Chi and late night belly dancing, and making new friends from faraway places. This summer, he challenged himself to only eat foods that are pink, a relatively easy task in the height of salmon season. He also recommends raspberry sherbet. It's worth mentioning that Dan graciously agreed to be a storyteller roughly 45 minutes ago, so please be gentle.
My story tonight is about a trip. I was going out from Detroit across down to Missouri to see my grandfather. Kind of looking for a pickup truck on the way. So I was riding out of Louisville, Kentucky, and it was raining like crazy. And I'm driving maybe a little bit too fast to try to get where I'm going. And there's these two semis in front of me. It starts raining so hard, I can't see anything but their taillights. And if I slow down, I can't see anything at all. So I just keep right up between these two semis riding for about 2 hours that way, until finally we come into the next town, this little tiny town in Illinois, South Illinois. And when I got off my bike, right when I was coming off the ramp, I felt a little shimmy. But you know, sometimes when you're riding too long a four-wheeler or a motorcycle, you kind of start feeling like the road keeps moving even when you get off your bike. And so I was kind of thinking maybe that's what it is. Just so I fill up, jump back on the interstate, and as soon as I pull off, I'm going slow, so my tires have centrifugal force, and I'm all over the road. And I had lost a bearing in my front tire of my bike. So I'm like, oh my gosh, you don't have time for this. It's late. It's like almost 5. I want to see my grandpa, you know. I got to get done with this adventure. Well, I pull back around to this little tiny town. And first thing I think is I got to find a shop. It's almost 5 o'clock. Everything's going to close up. And I need to tarp off my bike. I don't have a tarp with me. I was a little ill-prepared. So I need to find a store, throw a tarp on my bike to hide all my stuff so no one steals, and then find a motorcycle shop real quick. So I pull off, get off my bike. I walk up to the first car I see with someone, and I knock on the window. There's these two girls in there, and I say, hey, can I get a lift to Walmart? I just need to buy a tarp for my bike. I just broke down. And they roll up the window, and I hear, they're all talking in there. I'm like, this is weird. Now I'm just standing outside this window, feeling like something real awkward's about to happen. They roll back down, and they're like, yeah, come on, get in. I'm like, I don't know if I want to get in with these people. They seem real sketchy all of a sudden. So they're just sitting there, dead quiet, and I'm like, I wonder where they're going to take me. Like, I don't know this town. I know it's a tiny town, but this is sketchy. And one of them turns around, and she goes, if you're a serial killer, just don't today. And I'm like, me? I was like, I don't even know how to get to Walmart. Like, I'd be the worst serial killer out there. So they take me to Walmart. We get to be kind of friendly. They aren't freaked out by me. I still don't trust them. Get back to the bike. Tarp it off. I get out my flip phone. I'm going for a phone book. Different businesses. Nobody's got a phone book. So I'm like, all right, man. So I go into the steakhouse nearby. And they have a phone book. I call all the places that have motorcycle shops and sparing things. Nobody's open. And it's Saturday night. So they're going to be closed Sunday till Monday. And I need to get to Missouri. But I'm like, well, this is where I'm at. So I start chatting with people around there, settle into the bar to find a drink. Start chatting up people around there, and me and the bartender start getting along pretty good. He's a super nice guy. His name's Russell. He's the head bartender. He's got this super nice shirt and everything. We start chatting away, and I meet a couple other people. We're swapping stories, having a good time. And then I was like, man, I need to find a place to sleep tonight. Kind of need to figure some things out, thinking in my mind. So then Russell, about, I don't know, half hour goes by or whatever, you know. And I'm chewing on some biscuits, having whatever I'm drinking. I don't even know. And he goes, hey, you know, I get off in about an hour if you want to hang out. And I'm like, awesome. We'll see where this goes. This could be a good river. I'm going to follow this. So Russell gets off, and I'm thinking, this guy's like, he's cool. Because he's just, you know, flipping bottles, doing his thing. I'm like, this guy's probably like the Tom Cruise in Cocktail, you know? So then he gets off work, and he pulls off his white shirt, and he's got a Star Wars shirt on. I'm like, went down a few notches. He's still cool, but he's not the Tom Cruise I'm thinking, you know? So then we jump in his car, and he's like, yeah, man, you know, tell him about his life, and his little brother is having a hard time. He's with this girl, and they're living at his house, and he's upset because his brother's not making any money because it doesn't work. And I'm like, man, this is rough. You know, and he's like, hey, you don't have to work. I was going to this little pub and get a drink. I was like, yeah, I'm down. I'm like, whatever, dude. I'm just down to hang. He's like, yeah, so let's pop over. So we pop over, and he's telling about this place he really wants to get a job at. It's called the Bees. And he's like, man, it's the bee's knees. If I could just get a job here, I mean, I would be sailing in the clear. I'd be making bank. He's like, I wouldn't have to work two jobs. I could just work one. And I'm like, man, the bees. I feel like the way he's saying this, it sounded like the Marriott or something. I'm like, I should probably, but I'm an islander. I don't know about a lot of stateside stuff. So anyways, we're sitting. We're having a drink and chat. He's like, yeah, just get into the bees, man. And he's like, hey, you know what? I got a friend in town. I think they're having a big party. He's like, well, let me call him up. We'll go across town. Well, across town's like a block away. So we hop like a block away on foot to this other little place, and his friend's having a bachelorette party. So I find myself at this big bachelorette party, which was pretty fun. And I'm like, okay, this guy is pretty cool. You know, we're having a good time. And then he starts telling me, I'm like, you know, man, if you want to work at the Bees, you just gotta apply yourself and get in there. I was like, have you even applied there? Have you put up a resume? He's like, not yet, man. I'm like, well, you gotta get on that, dude. He's like, yeah, I do. And then he starts talking about some friend that he knew from high school who wanted to be a Navy SEAL, but he's 5'5". Everybody said he couldn't do it, and he ended up doing it. And I was like, yeah, that's great. So I'm like, take me to the Bees. Let's check this place out. So we go over there. It's Applebee's. I was like, dude, you just went down like four more. I mean, that's a great place to eat, but like head bartender of Applebee's? Like, I think you could do better. Like, you're a cool cat, you know? So he's like, yeah, let's pop by the liquor store on the way home and get my brother a couple beers. I'm like, yeah, cool. So we walk in there, and apparently the liquor store is a pub as well. This town only has pubs, I swear. So we go in there, and he buys some beer. Well, he runs into this Navy SEAL buddy he hasn't seen since high school. And his high school sweetheart, this Navy SEAL, lives in this town, so he comes back to see her. And so he's like, oh, man, you tell him, this is my buddy from Alaska. This is my Navy SEAL buddy. I'm like, okay, yeah, we're friends now, I guess. Which we were. And he's like, yeah. And then his buddy tells him about some house party. So we end up going to this house party. And I'm tired. I'm like, I've been in the rain. I got this broken motorcycle. I'm kind of hoping this guy's going to like crash his place. You know, we're just kind of filling the situation out. I'm like, whatever. He's like, you want to go to a party? I'm like, let's go to a party. I love parties. So we go to this party. And the first guy I meet at this party, we roll in, and this guy's kind of doing a little bit of this. And he goes, you know who I am? I'm like, no, I just got to tell you. I'm Doobie. I'm like, cool, Doobie. That's cool, dude. He's like, you know what I like to do? I could probably take a guess. He was like, I like to smoke weed. I was like, yeah, I kind of picked up on that. So we're hanging out at this little party, and it's really awkward because it's all dudes, one girl who's tied up with this one guy. That doobie will not leave alone. He's just chasing this girl all over the place. And it's awkward. And I'm sitting on this leather couch, and I kind of put my socks up because they're kind of wet and they're kind of cold, so I tuck them under me. And doobie's like, hey, keep your shoes off the couch. This is my leather. I was like, all right, huh? Find out doobie doesn't even live there. That's the first time he's ever even been there. It's ridiculous. So this night kind of plays on. I'm getting exhausted, but I meet some nice people, you know, a lot of characters. It got real, real interesting. We end up getting back to this guy's house at like 4 in the morning. I'm whipped. I'm exhausted. He just wanted to show me the best time. We got to be pretty good buddies. We're having a great time. But I don't know. He might have been partaking in some strange things that night because right as we get home, he's like, hey, let's sit outside for a minute. I was like, yeah, let's sit outside on your porch. You know, we have some deep chats about life. I'm like, man, you should come on my adventure with me. I'm going up to Alaska in a few weeks. He's like, yeah, maybe I'll jump on. I was like, yeah, you can get a much better bartending job up there, I'm sure, than Applebee's, you know? And so we're sitting on the park bench, and this guy, we're good buddies by now. And he just turns and he looks at me, I kid you not, he goes, hey, are you a vampire? And I'm thinking, I like this guy. He's cool. We're going to be buddies. This is weird. And he goes, I'm like, no, man, I'm not a vampire. He goes, your teeth are kind of sharp. Like your eye teeth. I was like, man, I wish someone had noticed that during like the whole Twilight thing was going down. That might have been kind of cool. But yeah, no, not you. And then he turns and looks at me and he goes, hey, man, you know, even if you're not a vampire and you don't want to tell me you are, but you are in secret, could you please just bite me so I can live forever? I really want to live forever. Oh, this guy, he's messed up or something. I'm like, dude, I'm really not. He's like, oh, he's so disappointed. So I go up to his place, crash out. He's got this couch, and the dog ate the whole foot of the couch out, so it's all springs, so your feet kind of like hang in there. And then he ate the head out, so I'm like, kind of like a rag doll. But it's cool. And we have another good chat. He's just real chatty. And I'm like, okay, man, well, tomorrow maybe you can decide if you want to come with me in 6 weeks or not. I'll give you my number, you know. But thanks for the place to stay. And in the morning, he takes me to Taco Bell for breakfast. And I'm just like, man, dude, I don't know about this guy, you know. And he goes, you know, I think you're my best friend. So apparently I was his best friend, but I don't think he was my best friend.
Madeline Pearman is next. She was born here in Kodiak and has lived here since birth. She helps kids' brains grow while also stopping them from picking their noses. For fun, she does lots of outdoor activities and learns to be spontaneous. Please welcome her onto the stage.
I just decided to do this while standing in line tonight so that I could get in with my friends. I'm not going to be as good as Dan. I have a little cheat sheet. My story about man's best friend tonight, or in my story about man's best friend is a brake barrel shotgun. So, to give a little background, I was living in the middle of nowhere, Alabama, by myself, in a very old little creaky house with big pecan trees growing on either side of it. And I slept with a gun by my bed every night anyways because I was by myself and I was scared. But during the time that this story takes place, it happened to be the week of my wedding, so tensions were high. And one of my bridesmaids had gotten to town, but nobody else had gotten to town from my family or anybody else in my wedding party. So my one bridesmaid and I decided that we're going to have a nice little mellow evening, which is not what it turned out to be, and go to Whole Foods and get some dinner and cook it and just chat the two of us before the craziness took place of the week. So we go and we get our food and we cook dinner, and we're sitting at my kitchen table eating and chatting, and all of a sudden the front door starts to rattle. Now, my bridesmaid is a bit of a drama queen, so she starts to freak out, and I'm trying to calm her down, and then the front door starts to rattle again. So she screams, and she takes off running to my bedroom, and of course, because she's so anxious, I freak out, and I run with her. We're in the bedroom, and she says, you need to call Trey, who is my fiancé at the time. Husband now. And so I call him, and I'm trying to stay calm and just kind of blaming her. Michelle is really freaked out, and you really need to get here fast because she's really scared that somebody's trying to break into the house. So he says, I'm on my way, but he's 30 minutes away. So as we're waiting, she's still really freaking out. And then we start to hear footsteps in the hallway. So I take this brake barrel shotgun, and I'm thinking it could be one of three people in the house. It could be Tyler or Shane, which were two of our groomsmen, or it could be someone who wants to kill me and rob me. Either way, I don't really want to shoot anybody. I'm about to get married in 5 days, and that just seems like a lot of unnecessary stress. After I load the gun and I like flip it up, in my head, I'm thinking it's supposed to make a sound. It's supposed to like go so that they know that I have a gun, and then I'm gonna shoot them if they walk through the door. Because if somebody walks through that door, I don't care who it is, I'm shooting them. I'm gonna kind of edit the words I use, but you can use your imagination. So I yell, "I have a rubber ducking gun, and it is rubber ducking loaded." And a few minutes after that, my fiancé pulls into the driveway. It took him probably 10 minutes to get there instead of 30, so I must have sounded at least a little panicked on the phone. And not only does he show up, but the two groomsmen show up, who I thought that it could have been, Tyler and Shane. So I'm thinking, okay, so if it's not them, it's someone trying to kill me. So they go through the house, and they check all of the rooms in the house, and Trey pops his head into the bedroom door and says, "It's me. There's nobody here." And then he walks in with, like, a sawed-off 12-gauge, and I'm like, okay. He's taking this seriously, I like that, but there's somebody here. And I hear it again, the footsteps in the hallway. I'm like, Trey, there it is. You have to hear it. You hear it. Somebody's here, and it's not you, and it's not Tyler, and it's not Shane, so get ready. And he says, wait, hold on, listen. And we hear it again. And he goes, that sound? And I said, yeah. And he said, Madeline, that's the pecans falling on the roof.
For our last storyteller before our intermission, we have Mark Downey, and he is a photojournalist from Northwest Montana. He's a longtime fishing guide, master gardener, and garden designer, and he's supposed to be writing a cookbook on wild foods of the Rocky Mountains. He's used to commercial fish on Bristol Bay. After that, he wrote for the Great Falls Tribune newspaper and was a Western correspondent for the New York Times. He and his girlfriend moved to Kodiak 2 months ago. Please welcome him to the stage.
I have a problem. I'm whitetail deer hunting on the Rocky Mountain front in Montana, and I'm parked at a gate, and right on the other side of the gate are about 24 Charolais bulls, and I want to go through that gate, but they're in my way. I don't know if you know what Charolais bulls are, but they're huge. They're a French bull, and they're white, and their heads are about this big. And the snow's coming down, and if you squint your eyes just a little bit and use your imagination, they look so much like some mammoth ice age beast. You can see a big horns on them, fending off saber-toothed tigers and cave bears. And I don't know if I can just push the gate open and push the bulls away and drive through and everything will be fine, or if I open the gate, some will get out, and another one will stomp me. So that's my problem. I just don't know what to do. What I really know about livestock would rattle around in a thimble. And I'm not really a cowboy. I mean, I have the boots and the jeans and the buckle, but and I know real cowboys, but I'm not. So I'm sitting there in my truck, I'm drinking coffee, I'm not too worried about it, but I'd like to go through the gate, and then a rig pulls up next to me, and it's a ranch hand with a flatbed pickup and a load of hay. And I look over, you know, when you see a guy like that, you think he's probably got a dog, because ranch hands usually have dogs. They're man's best friend, and they're handy around cattle. And in fact, my cow dog's at home right now wondering when I'm coming home and supposed to be doing my laundry, paying the bills. But I look over at this ranch, and he doesn't have a dog. He has a cat. And it's not really a ordinary cat. It's a black and white tomcat with a Christmas red collar. The cat's standing in the ranch hand's lap, and the window is open. The cat's got his paws up on the windowsill and his head out the window. And he's just looking around like he owns the place. He looks so happy. He's looking all over. His ears are kind of back, all jaunty. I mean, he looks happy. Like he owns the place, and he's back again today to make sure everybody knows it. And by the way, he's got the bull's food yet again. And so I'm looking at this, and the ranch hand looks at me and goes, "I know." He says, I train all my pets to ride with me, and they just go with me everywhere I go. So, just about that time, the cat jumps out of the window and jumps down onto the ground, and the ranch hand says, "Watch this." If I'd have had a beer, I'd have put it down and watched, but I didn't. I was drinking coffee. And the cat saunters over, and he goes under the fence, and goes right over in the middle of the bulls and sits down. And so we're drinking coffee, and those bulls, finally one of those bulls just has to go over to the cat. And he goes over kind of slow and puts his head down. He's just towering over this cat. And the cat the bull puts his big old nose down there, and the cat just goes, wham! It's like all five claws right in that big rubbery nose. The bulls are pretty catty, too. I mean, he had all 4 feet off the ground. And the cat went darting through the other bull's legs and back under the fence and came back over to the truck. And I thought that was pretty impressive. And we're sitting there, and then the ranch hand said, "I'll tell you what, I know you need to go through there, and but I got to go through and feed these bulls, so I'll just drive through, but then I'll wave to you, and that means it's time for you to come through." He said, "Because you got to know that it's not really safe for you to drive through these bulls, because if they start fighting, they don't really care about you, and they will smash into your truck and crush it. And my truck's insured against it, and yours isn't." And so I'm thinking, well, maybe he's being a little dramatic, you know, but maybe he isn't. And am I covered for this? Am I in good hands? I don't know. So he opens the gate and he goes through, and it seems just fine. And he gets out, but the truck is still rolling across the field. It's that old trick, you know, where you have it in compound low, and like something wedged between the seat and the accelerator, so the truck will just keep rolling along. And then he jumps on the flatbed of the truck, and he's throwing hay off for the bulls, and they kind of drift in behind the truck. And then he waves to me, and I drive up alongside him, and I have my window down, and I wave thank you to him and smile, and he smiles and nods and chuck some more hay off for the bulls. And then I get just a little farther, and I can see into the cab of his pickup, and there's the feeding cat sitting on the horse blanket seat cover with the heater blowing, licking his chest and cleaning his shiny coat.
And to introduce our fifth storyteller of the night, Craig is a lifelong and third-generation Kodiak resident. His parents, Dr. Bob and Marianne Johnson, are retired here with no plans to leave, and Craig doesn't plan to leave either because he doesn't know any better. So please give a round of applause for Craig.
So I want to show you this plaque on the back that I can see. It says, "To Craig, loved here." It really is from my dear wife of 36 years. It says, "My husband, a soft shoulder to cry on, a firm chest to rest on, a loving heart to rely on, and my best friend." She really did give it to me, and it really does hang in a place of honor in my office. And not only that, my parents are here tonight, and they've been married 63 years. This year will be 64. When you've been married a number of years, when the years start to pile up, you start to see the other side of love, the flip side of the coin. And so I want you to, with me, look at love from both sides now. Matt said I might be in trouble with this. I saw a quote. I heard a quote, and it just struck me. It just struck a chord in me when I heard it. This is a quote from Jim Carrey. "Behind every great man is a woman rolling her eyes." When I first heard that, I thought, that's me. I can relate. I was so excited, I couldn't wait to take it and share it with Terry. So I just about rushed to share this with her. And I said, you know, I knew about the behind a man is a woman. You know, they're doing better things together because they're more than they could do apart. And they're supporting each other on the bigger and better things. But the part that was that rolling your eyes part, that's what was getting me. And I could see, you know, I'm a man. And I kind of think I'm pretty great. And I definitely have a woman behind me, rolling her eyes. So I said to her, as soon as I could get with her, I said, "What do you think about this? Behind every man is a woman, rolling her eyes." No hesitation. She'd not heard this before. No hesitation. She immediately says, "Forget great." Behind every man is a woman rolling. And then I knew it really did apply to me. Dear sweet Ruth Graham, another person that's been married a long time, was once asked, "Have you and Billy ever considered divorce?" She said, "No, I can honestly tell you, we have never considered divorce. Murder? Absolutely." As the years pile on and you're married longer, your life and your relationship and your friendship can start to sound like an old country and western song. Maybe with a title like this: "How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away?" If the phone don't ring, you'll know it's me. I keep forgetting, I forgot about you. I'm so miserable without you, it's like you were here. If I'd shot you when I wanted to, I'd be out of here by now. We've got some country and western fans out here. Some years ago, Terry had a job interview right here in town. She's been out of the workforce for a while, and this new employer wanted to know, as they had a panel of people from that company, "Why aren't you at your last job? Why aren't you going back to your old employer?" She had an answer for him, but she had to think about it for a minute, just how to put it. And she said, "Well, it was kind of like a gambler working in a casino. Her old job had been at Artinger's, fine furnishings. And maybe like a gambler working in a casino, not usually bringing home a paycheck, that was kind of how it was for Terry. Maybe some furniture would come home, but not so much the paycheck. They say you should take someone you love someplace they've never been before. And for me, this wasn't hard. I knew what I could do. I had this saved. I saved it for our 30th wedding anniversary. Terry, when we first met, had a little statue, metal statue replica of Michelangelo's David, about this tall. She always loved Italy. She said, "I want to go to Italy. I have a lifelong dream to go to Italy." And so I said, "Honey, 30-year wedding anniversary, great news. Big surprise. We're going to Italy." She said, "How?" I said, "That's the best part. I'll take care of everything. You just sit back and relax. Don't lift a finger. Don't do a thing. I'll make all the arrangements." She said, "No." "If you make the arrangements, we might get to Italy, but we probably won't get back." And so just September passed. A few months ago, we actually got to Italy. It took me only 6 years to get a group tour that she would approve to go to Italy. And we did make it there and back. It was a nice visit to Italy. Her dream came true. And I made none of the arrangements. Terry has a mother's heart. I sometimes say to her, "I don't need another mother." She says, "Oh, yes, you do." She has been the greatest mother to our three children, one in heaven, and she's been the best wife for me all these years we've been together. I really mean that. When the boys were younger and they might get a serious girlfriend, they sometimes would ask me, "Dad, what do you think of this girl?" And I would say, I would kind of want to steer that conversation this way. "Well, how does this girl's heart line up with your mom's?" And if they said it was a good match, I would say, "You have nothing to worry about." Some years ago, I had to ask myself, was she the one for me? Was Terry the one for me? And I didn't have to think about it very long before I knew I could look the whole world over and not find another heart like hers. No use even trying. She's the hub of our family wheel. She's the heart of our family, as you might expect. She's my best friend forever, the apple of my eye. And yes, I know how to sleep on the couch.
To introduce Mary Ann Condro, she has lived in the big city of Kodiak for just over a year now, after spending half of her life in the Southeast Alaskan community of Cake. She is a retired educator and now takes care of her two Kodiak granddaughters on her Memaw daycare days. It often includes a story in your head, which is very good practice for her storytelling interests. She recently returned from Kauai, where she gathered with family and friends for the Christmas holiday and had a very special wedding. Each gathering usually included a beach or a pool and a swimsuit and a few umbrella drinks. So therefore, if you find spaces of silence in her storytelling this evening, it may be due to jet lag, or too much sun, or one too many umbrella drinks over the past few weeks. So please welcome her on the stage.
He was a mountain of a man, bigger than life. Everywhere he went, his world was filled with love and light. The story I'm going to share tonight is about this a mountain of a man and a little girl. The mountain man and the little girl knew each other indirectly for about 30 years. But then over the last 10 years or so, this little girl became a lifeline to this mountain of a man. The story begins in June of 2002 at the wedding of my daughter Karen. In Washington State, she was marrying her friend Jacob, and family and friends were gathered there, and it was a great celebration. So after the wedding, my husband Leo and I, with some really good friends, took a road trip into Oregon. We went up the Mackenzie River and stayed in a rusty cabin. We went out to the Oregon coast and stayed there for a while and finished our journey and near Eugene at the Oregon Country Fair. And then we began our journey back to Alaska, to the town of Cape, which is a Tlingit village that we had gone to teach school there for 2 years and stayed. At that time, it was 27 years. So we flew in the jet to Sitka and then caught a ferry. And during this journey time, Leo was starting to not feel very good. And he thought kind of maybe had the flu or he'd been traveling. So when we got back to Cape, he made an appointment at the clinic and went to kind of check to see how things were going. Well, the PA there wanted him to do a blood lab, a draw, and so they drew Leo's blood, but they have to send it to Sitka to be labbed. So they asked us to come back the next day to kind of check on things. And she thought, yeah, most likely you have the flu, Leo. So we came back the next day. The lab results were back from Sitka, and there was lots of red flags. So we, and she had suggested that we go to Petersburg and see our regular doctor. And so we packed just a bag for the weekend. Leo had his cut-off extra tufts on. We took a small plane to Petersburg, went right to the hospital to emergency. Dr. Mark Tosillo checked, wanted again to do blood labs, and he gave Leo a physical examination. His lungs, he had a lot of fluid in his lungs, and also his spleen was about the size of a small football. And so the blood work, they did it twice. It had changed so much from the labs from Sitka that they did it twice, thinking they must have made a mistake. So that evening, Dr. Tosillo came to our hotel room and said, my suggestion, there's something big going on. My suggestion is either go to Anchorage or Seattle. And Leo said, let's go to Seattle. So the next morning, we took the regular jet to Seattle and went right to the hospital, and Leo was admitted. They started right away with Leo on fluids, and they did a chest x-ray. And the next day, they said, well, he's got pneumonia. So they started him on a medication for the pneumonia. And then by the next day, he was really not getting any better. So they put him in intensive care. They had a lot of tests that they wanted to do on him. Now, one of it was infectious disease people, and they had taken samples of the culture in his lungs, and nothing had happened. So Leo hadn't been sleeping very well, and the nurse had said, well, tomorrow they're going to do another culture. And Leo said, you need to do it now because I don't think I'm going to be here tomorrow. And so they came in, they took a culture, and that time, it takes several hours, but that time it cultured a bacteria called tularemia. And if any of you know of tularemia, it's also called rabbit Skinner's disease, and you get it from an infected animal. But in Leo's case, he had breathed it, he had ingested it into his lungs, and so it's called pneumonia, tularemia, or sometimes typhoid. And we met several doctors who said they'd never met a patient who was alive that had tularemia. So what needed to happen, the medication that they needed to give Leo, the number one medication they would give him, would also kill his kidneys. Well, his kidneys were already failing. And there was a lot of stuff going on. So what they did is they gave him the second drug of choice. And so overall, he was in the hospital for 17 days. I was there most of those times too. But for 17 days. And during that time, they put him on hemodialysis. And so when we left the hospital 17 days later, we stayed with my sister who lives in the Seattle area. And Leo continued dialysis through the Northwest Kidney Center in Seattle 3 days a week for 4 hours each day. The idea of us going back to Cape was not likely. But during that same time, they started Leo training him to do peritoneal dialysis, which we could do in Cape. And so he was having this training to be able to do this. Also, he was doing a workup to see if he could be a kidney transplant recipient. And so he was doing this workup at the same time. 110 days after he initially went into the hospital, we returned to Cape. Both of us were school teachers. And Leo doing peritoneal dialysis was probably the best science experiment that his class could ever have. We continued along. Things were good. The one problem was kidney transplant recipient, they wouldn't put you on the kidney transplant list as long as we lived in Cape, because we couldn't guarantee we could be to Seattle in 6 hours. So that's the time I decided that I would see if maybe I could be a kidney donor, and I did the same workup. At one time, I had 11 appointments in 3 days. My last appointment was a CT scan to make sure I even had two kidneys, because a lot of people only have one and never know. I did have two kidneys, and so we went back to CAKE with the idea of preparation that in June of 2003, I would give Leo my kidney. So when June came around, the operation went fine, and this is where Leo met the little girl. We called the kidney the little girl kidney, and she worked really hard. We had to spend the whole summer, multiple medical appointments, lots of drugs, and the little girl kidney held right in there. She was really, really good. We were able to go back to CAKE, and Leo and I both continued teaching that next year. He was not on dialysis, just had to take a lot of drugs. But and the little girl was doing great. Once in a while, Leo would have some kind of issue that went on, and then we'd have to call her the little bitch girl, and we did that. But she worked really hard. Then February of 2002, we had an incident in our house in CAKE. A friend had come over to watch a movie, and all of a sudden Leo passed out. His potassium was very high. His hematocrit, the red blood cells, were very low. The friend and I gave Leo CPR. We brought him back about the same time the EMTs got there. And he had to be medevaced to Sitka, where they gave him 4 units of red blood, and then medevaced again, Guardian flight, to Seattle. He made it through. The little girl kidney was wonderful. And but after that time, Leo had to have a blood transfusion of red blood cells every 5 to 6 weeks. So we were spending a lot of time going to Sitka, to the Search Hospital. His blood had to come from Seattle because of his transplanted condition. We had some in Seattle, and we even had one here in Kodiak. But by January of 2014, it became apparent that we needed to be the majority of our time in Seattle with just short visits to CAKE and Alaska. And then in March, the little girl kidney was continuing to work really hard, but Leo was very tired. He had a lot of chronic conditions, things going on that we just medically could not take care of, so we had some hard decisions to make. And Ben and Stephanie and my two granddaughters from Kodiak, they planned a trip in March of that same year to come to Seattle or come to Washington, not because their father was ill, but because we were welcoming our fourth granddaughter, Addie, to my daughter, Karen, and her husband, Jacob. And just 10 days later, on March 18th, 2014, as my Tlingit family of CAKE would say, Leo walked into the forest, and he took my kidney, that little girl kidney, with him, and so much of our heart. But the Tlingit people also have a belief that when a person dies, they really die twice. The first time they die is when their physical body leaves. And the second time they die is when we forget to tell their story. So I'm sharing this story tonight so that I can remember. Our last storyteller of the night is Matt Freeman. He was born in Vancouver, Washington, and he came to Kodiak because his parents made him. He is a fifth grade teacher at East Elementary, so storytelling is a big part of what he does. He likes to sing, act, teach U.S. history, play ukulele, write songs, and tell stories. And once he was held captive by a chicken, but that's another story.
Yeah, if we ever have a theme about chickens, I got to do it. But I want to tell you about my dog, Jeff, and about one of the times that he almost died. I've kind of lost count. There was the time he fell through the ice at Island Lake, and a time he almost got run over by a semi in Winnemucca. But the time I want to tell you about was when he was attacked by this beast. Let me explain about my dog a little more. Jeff was not a large dog, medium sized. He was a mixed breed, not by any planning on our part. He was supposed to be more of a purebred cocker spaniel, but something didn't work out. We think a black lab came by. And, we never found out for sure, but Jeff was certainly he was a very agreeable dog, nice black and white coloring, friendly, mild mannered. You couldn't ask for a nicer dog. He's a very polite dog. He hardly ever barked. Didn't make any messes. One thing about him was he was obsessed with fetching sticks. It's like the one thing we were able to train him to do, and he just like latched on. I mean, literally latched on. And he just carried a stick everywhere. It was like an accessory. You know, he was never at a loss for a stick. He could always find some piece of wood around, and he would just very politely come when he wanted you to throw it. He'd just come right up and politely drop it in your lap or in the middle of whatever you were doing and wait. And, you know. Sometimes I'd mess with them and pretend to throw it, and then I'd throw it over that way. You know, and sniff around. And if he needed help, I'd go, hey, can you go find it? And he never held any grudges. He was a sweethearted guy, yeah. Yeah, and his definition of fetching stick was really broad. I mean that it was really broad. I mean, sometimes he would come up with like just a normal stick. Sometimes he would come up with like a sliver. Like he'd get a piece of rotten wood and kind of chew on it for a while, and there wasn't much left except something about that big. So yeah, Harry could come right up there. Really? One time, though, he really got me good. I was cracking up because he picked up a 2x4 that was this long, and I was like, he's like, he can hardly even hold onto it with his mouth. He's like, argh. I'm like, he has no sense of proportion. It's crazy, you know. He looks so ridiculous. And he turned his head. I'm sitting right next to him. It suddenly became less funny. But the time that he almost died, it was just one of those scary times where you just think that someone's going to die. And in this case, I thought it was going to be Jeff, but I wasn't sure. It could have been me. But he used to come around on my paper route. I served the neighborhoods around Island Lake and Shahafka Acres, and I was making about $1 a day back then. And so it wasn't in it for the money. But there was this one section of the last neighborhood that we served that had this huge Saint Bernard. It's this huge hulking thing. It was a hairy, angry, slobbery dog. His whole life was like about from here to here on a running line. And so all that he could do was just like watch people go by him and bark at them, especially if it was a dog on the by. He was a bitter animal. I feel bad for him now, but at the time I was just like, spare him, and he's so weak, come by him. I'm delivering paper. Come by, and just would go to the opposite side of the street, from this dog. And it didn't matter if we were this side or that side, he just always came out and he'd go, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, come on, come on. He'd go right up to the edge of the leash. Probably part of why he was so bitter. But, we knew what he was saying. So it was definitely the most nerve-wracking part of my entire route. And we tried a couple things. He said, Jeff, let's try it. Instead of going right, down the road, let's cut through the woods. We'll go behind that that fourplex over there. We'll come back around. And maybe the one would notice it. Let's try that. Okay, so Jeff's good. He's up for anything. So go behind the house there. Come around the side. I see you. But, he's on a pretty good chain. Never Nothing ever happened. Just made your blood pound a little bit. Except one time we'd given up on the trying to, you know, go around the backwoods, so we just, like, you know, quietly kept their heads down and scampered across, and he was coming out and and the chain snapped. And we could see what was about to happen. This thing really did hate us. And he was gone for us, and we were kind of moving back around, and there wasn't much time to do anything. He was right on Jeff. Now, Jeff and I were like, for a moment, looking at each other like, Jeff's like, you know, you didn't help out here? You're supposed to be my protector. Help me out, you know. Anyway, before we got through that discussion, the dog was on him. And it got him by the throat. And I was like, good thing Jeff didn't have fun. So, yeah, just like a rag doll. Threw him down. And I was pretty sure that was going to be the end of Jeff. And I ran up to the house and knocked on the door. And a very nice little old lady in tennis shoes came out. And I said, your dog just broke its chain and it attacked my dog. She said, what? Your dog got off its chain. She said, oh, well, would you just go get him for me? Go get him for you. This lady had no idea that a monster had been unleashed. I mean, literally unleashed on an unsuspecting town. And then my dog, I'm like, how was Jeff doing, by the way? You're probably wondering. You know, did he make it? Yes, he did. There were several other times he almost died, and this wasn't going to be that time. So Jeff got up and was like, oh. What I hadn't anticipated was that Jeff had a lot of thick skin around his neck, you know. It wasn't really noticeable because, you know, covered with fur. And so when that dog had got him, it didn't crush his larynx. It just grabbed the scruff and then it went off. And you could tell by the wag its tail just swaggering off like, freedom! But there was nothing that Jeff and I could do at that point. It was a bigger problem than the both of us. Literally bigger than the both of us. And so we just, we were kind of looked at each other. We slunk off home and just licked our wounds. Metaphorically. Jeff might have lived. Yeah, missed that dog. Thank you.
Galley Table Storytelling is made possible through a partnership with the Kodiak Arts Council and Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation. Visit us online at galleytables.com to find the date and location of the next live storytelling event. You can also browse our archives and listen to past stories or sign up to be a storyteller.